This is Alan Minsky, and I'm sitting in for Margaret Prescott, who will be back tomorrow on Sojourner Truth. And I'm joined now by Arun Gupta, who is a founding editor and the publisher of The Independent newspaper, which is out of New York City. And he is writing a book on the politics of food for Haymarket Books. Welcome to the show, Arun Gupta.
Thank you, Alan. Great to be with you today.
People might be familiar with hearing Arun Gupta occasionally as a guest on Democracy Now! And other shows on the Pacifica Network. I met him at a media conference about 5 years ago. I was very impressed hearing him speak, and I followed his work ever since. And so I'm very excited to talk to him today because I feel among the various voices that we have in progressive media in the United States, I think that Arun Gupta is one of the people who doesn't really give it to us leftists very easy. He often can be quite pointed in the reality dose that he provides for those of us who want to see a strong social justice movement emerge. And so he is one of the best practitioners of self-criticism on the left. And that's pretty much what I want to speak with him today about, because, you know, in the series that I've been doing, Building a Powerful Left in the United States, it's predicated on the quandary. Why is it that 3 to 4 years after basically global capitalism melted down, which would seem to be a predicate towards the development of a powerful left, especially in the wake of it when the wealth is accrued even more and more in the hands of the few, and the average person has been struggling ever more hard over these past few years, seems to be a formula in which a powerful left would emerge. And yet, in terms of a really powerful, socially transformative left, a left like existed, say, 100 years ago to 60 years ago that changed the course of human history, it's nowhere in evidence, if we're honest with ourselves, in the United States. There may be some signs, but they're pretty much just little glimmers. In a recent article in Alternet, Arun Gupta wrote, it's called "The American Dream as We Know It is Obsolete." And I want to talk to him about a lot of the ideas in that article, and in particular, the critique he has about rebuilding the middle class as being a focus for the left in the United States. Arun Gupta, though, do you want to maybe outline the argument you offer in that article?
Sure. What I'm arguing is that we see in this present moment of economic crisis that's been going on for well over 3 years, followed on by attack on the public sector and workers, a lot of progressive voices and labor leaders saying that we need to be defending the middle class. And I cite a number of examples, such as Jim Hightower to Richard Trumka, and about how what's going on right now is a fight for the middle class and we need to rebuild the American dream. And my response to this has been, really? And so what I do is I investigate what exactly is meant by the middle class, who are they trying to appeal to, and just all the many ways in which this idea that we need to be fighting for the middle class is highly problematic. I start off by saying, look, first of all, the idea that what's going on is an attack on the middle class is not really accurate. There is a section of the middle class that is certainly being attacked, and there are some middle class social programs that are under attack. But on the flip side, this right-wing movement, the Tea Party movement that's really just exploded in the last 2 years, is very much a middle-class movement. We know that. And this is a bit of a different topic, but I will say it should not be dismissed as an astroturf movement. Despite the role of the Koch brothers, despite the role of Fox News, there's something very real at the core of the Tea Party movement, and it's a middle-class movement. And they are attacking other people who are in the middle class, but who they see as receiving these unfair advantages in terms of state-provided jobs, pensions, benefits, etc. Now, I'm not agreeing with them. I'm just trying to analyze what is the historical moment at this point. And in fact, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy there, because for all the attacks on the public sector, union, social welfare programs, it never says word one about the mortgage interest rate tax deduction. If you add up all social welfare programs, now I'm not including Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, much of which is funded through payroll taxes, in fact, the overwhelming majority. But if we look at all other social welfare programs, maybe it comes to about $100 million a year at the federal level. Meanwhile, the interest rate deduction for homeowners next year will cost the federal government $132 billion. So if you were really serious about reducing the deficit, the Tea Party would say, like, we need to also cut this deduction. So the point is, you have one part of what you can call the middle class, and the Tea Party tends to be more entrepreneurial. Again, though, there's not this recognition in all the ways that they are subsidized by the government.
Well, I was going to quote from your article about who you're talking about, and to some extent challenge your point, which I do think is a very fertile point. I think there's incredible insight, and I think it's very important for progressives to take it to heart. So in the article you write, the tens of millions of Americans who embrace individualism, right, and this is sort of at the core of contemporary American conservative rhetoric, if not actually ideology, right, but at least the rhetoric, are a very real force that is flexing its political muscle right now. Additionally, in terms of analyzing who is the middle class, it is much more those entrepreneurs, supervisors, managers, realtors, small business owners, and self-employed plumbers, carpenters, cooks, doctors, lawyers, accountants, financial planners, and myriad other professions found in the Tea Party and the Republican Party than the blue-collar workers and public sector employees who lack control over their work. And I suppose the reason I want to just sort of throw out a devil's advocate type challenge to you is because the list that you give there, those people, of course, have also been feeling the tremendous economic pressure. So if the argument from the left, because a middle-class society and a socialist society, just to look at that for a second, they're very similar. The wealth is concentrated into the middle sectors. Those people who you're pointing out are indeed middle class, they're also suffering tremendously over these past few years compared to how they've been doing in other parts of the post-1979 American economy. So shouldn't the left also try to put forward a program that talks about an equitable, just society where their lives will not be under the squeeze that they're experiencing in these past few years?
Sure, and I completely agree with you. But what's going on here is you have people who have something to lose. If we look at all the polling data on the Tea Party movement, there's this archetypical figure that emerges. It's someone who's older, over 50, even a retiree, white, male, conservative, a bit above average income, and likely in the South or West. But, you know, as opposed to a lot of the way the left tries to caricature the Tea Party movement, these are not rich people. Now, they're comfortably middle class in terms of both their household income and in terms of their consumptive lifestyle. And that's how I'm presenting the middle class. And what I'm trying to say there, maybe a little subtly, is that, like, look, we need to get back to this notion of working class. I have a friend who is a union activist and very active in his union in New York City, and he constantly gets emails sent out by the AFL-CIO in the name of Richard Trumka. And he told me after reading my article, it's like, it's always middle class. They always say middle class, middle class, middle class.
Right.
You never hear the term once, working class, right, from the AFL-CIO. So what I'm trying to do there is draw a distinction. And this also goes back decades. This,
right,
is a bit of a side point, but I think it's important. If you look at really what went on in the 1968 election, that Nixon beat the Democrat Humphrey, and you also had Wallace, it was really that supervisory, managerial, professional class of whites who went for Nixon. Humphrey actually did get a majority of working class and unionized whites. And that's very important to remember, that there is a real class distinction that we're trying to paper over. And at a deeper level, this is what I'm trying to get at, is like, look at this history of the 1950s. And one of the things I think that is really kind of tragically humorous about the present moment is you have both progressives and the Tea Party who idealize, in many ways, the 1950s. The Tea Party movement thinks everything was great in the 1950s. Of course, that's when you had tax rates on the rich were 91%. You did have much more robust social welfare. And you also had kind of a crazy right wing that was running around from all the anti-communists, the John Birch Society, people screaming about fluoridation of drinking water. So it wasn't really as ideal as they like to imagine it. On the other side, you have people like Paul Krugman, who just gets loopy when he talks about the 1950s. I mean, he actually writes, quote, "It was a society without extremes of wealth or poverty, a society of broadly shared prosperity." And I was just like, really? I mean, there were no Rockefellers or Mississippi sharecroppers. He's talking about he grew up in this era. That's kind of a ridiculous thing to say on his part. He should know much better. But sure, there was not nearly as much social inequality today. But at the same time, work was alienating, racism was institutionalized. This is the height of American apartheid, Jim Crow. There was no real sense of community. The sexual mores were extremely repressive, and daily life was atomizing, meaningless, and suffocating. So is this an ideal that we on the left really want to return to? And of course, this whole society was intimately connected to the war state. The U.S. was in this period going around, engaging in all sorts of coups, supporting all sorts of dictators, proxy wars, assassinations in the Third World, and there was a direct material benefit for this, you know, so we could keep cheap copper coming from Chile, bananas from Guatemala, sugar from Cuba, oil from Iran, rubber from Indonesia, tin from Bolivia, and so on. And these cheap commodities ensured that American industry would be able to have low-cost input, and the American working class was able to enjoy this highly consumptive lifestyle. And then on top of this, you had the whole terror of imminent nuclear war hanging over society. There are a lot of things that were fundamentally screwed up about this society, and it's not like we've overcome these problems. I mean, sure, you do have a little more kind of ability to express yourself in terms of identity in the suburbs, but it's still, this is a lifestyle that is meaningless, atomizing, and suffocating.
This is Alan Minsky. I'm sitting in for Margaret Prescott, and I'm speaking with Arun Gupta, who is a founding editor and the publisher of The Independent newspaper, which is published out of New York City. And in your article that I cited earlier, The American Dream as We Know It, It Is Obsolete, you do a fantastic job, by the way, of critiquing how even in this era where the middle class grew in the post-war period coming out of the Rooseveltian New Deal, and even but beginning with the New Deal, it was predicated on this notion of sort of American corporatism, the way that the society and the economy were structured, with organized labor as sort of a junior partner. And you're very pointed in the critique of U.S. labor movement, even from that era, the height of its power in American society, that as people get enthused about the labor movement in the wake of the popular uprising in Wisconsin, that this model of corporatism is something that has to be moved past for a real powerful working class-based labor movement. One more point of being devil's advocate here, but maybe perhaps not. I want to throw this out to you. If you look at the successes of the left throughout history, and again, the left, of course, began as a term from the French Revolution. The people who sat on the left side of the parliament were more for the greater distribution of wealth being more equitable, but in particular, having more people have a say in the political decision-making in the society. And the people who sat on the right side of the parliament were for only the few making these decisions about who controls society. So in that sense, like, you can even look at Egypt and say this is a classically leftist, even though people maybe aren't thinking of it that way, because this was about having popular control of the society as opposed to just the very few who were the Mubaraks and the people close to the Mubaraks. But if you look at the left, especially in terms of economics, the main selling point of the left from the French Revolution forward, when it came through Marxism, through Rooseveltian New Deal, through European social democracy, is to say we are going to provide not only more equitable distribution of wealth, but for the average person, we're going to lift them up economically. They're going to have a better life. They're going to have more vacation time. They're going to be more economically secure. They're going to have health care, etc. Do you think, given all that goes on in the global economy, this global financial crisis, plus the looming, ever-growing ecological crisis that's coming down, that the era of the left putting that forward as the core message, that we will improve your material well-being, if you're an average person in the society, that that is, in a sense, a dishonest line for the left to take at this point. I argue that we're not past that point yet. But I hear some people on the left say that that really shouldn't really be the focus of a newly configured and revitalized left.
There's a lot of work here. One, yes, we obviously want everyone to have the basic things in life. Everyone should be able to enjoy the means of social reproduction. You know, these should be a fundamental right. You know, everyone has a fundamental right to decent housing, to food, to health care, to education, to work, to a pension, retirement of some sort. But the problem is that the left is very autonomistic, and this becomes the end in and of itself, and it's what can be termed biological reductionism. This is part of the problem that I'm critiquing in terms of, you know, when people say we need to be fighting for the middle class, because there are greater goods and greater goods beyond this. What about the good life? What about the just life? What about the life of virtue? The left used to fight for the highest ideals, and it's pretty much abandoned that ground completely. We don't want all these things just so people can lead their consumptive lifestyles, because for one, that is meaningless. I think just endless consumption, it clearly is. We live in a society fraught with anxiety, with depression, with all sorts of like social and individual disorders. But more than that, we want people to have meaning in life. That is a great pursuit, and the left has gotten away from this, and it sees everything in material terms. And that's important, but we should understand that the material terms are necessary but not sufficient. And we need to be speaking to these higher ideals. And it's also, how do these things get organized in society? Because if all you're speaking of is the material terms, then it's very hard not to be dragged down that road of consumption.
I have to say, of course, that I agree perfectly with everything you're saying. But from my point of view, again, right now, in terms of the American economy, most households are underwater. So it doesn't matter what their accrued assets are. They're working all of their lives and they're drowning. It can all be taken down a level, and the exchange can be for the very things you're talking about. And as it's taken down from that, so maybe the assets that they possess aren't as high valued, but they get their lives back. And they're no longer underwater. It's living with this debt burden that I think really can be focused on by the left as well.
Yes, but this also gets into the complexities of what is going on now, and why we can't just try to recreate this historical moment that passed 50, 60 years ago. There were two huge factors. One, there was a powerful left, both domestically and internationally, which is the context where capital made the social compact with labor. You know, labor made this Faustian bargain in terms of, okay, we're going to purge the radical left. So it allowed them to reach a peace with capital. They would maintain the labor peace. In exchange, they would get steadily rising wages and benefits every year. But the thing for capital is also, you had a notion of national capital in those days, and that's where corporatism comes from. And just to be clear, corporatism is not referring to corporations. Corporatism, the root of it is corpus, body. It generally means a political system where the government is seen as kind of this neutral mediator between competing interests, and those could be the military, the peasantry, workers, business, industry, merchants, etc., and the government mediates between these large bodies to reach agreements. And the New Deal was very much a corporatist system. Mussolini in Italy was also a corporatist system. So what we had then was, because U.S. capital, you did have a national capital, and it was tied to this huge internal domestic market, it did have a need to reach an agreement with labor. That's gone. Capital has really unmoored itself from geography. And so we need to rethink exactly how we are going to essentially attack capital, because this is a war that's going on. You know, Warren Buffett, the richest man in the world at various points, is very clear. He said a few years ago, there's a class war going on, and it's my class, the upper class, that is waging this war and winning this war. So in terms of this class war, we can't have this return to corporatism. And that's what happened with Obama's election, that there was this kind of like unconscious revival of corporatism, because people thought that Obama would negotiate between capital and labor movements. And it was a very seductive vision, to be sure. And we would have this Green New Deal, that because corporate capitalism essentially blew up, it blew itself up, that there was this leverage that we were going to have over it, and then we could force them into this Green New Deal, whereby the auto industry would be retooled such that they would be building wind turbines and solar panels, and the banks that had failed would be funding it, and we would return to this new era of prosperous middle-class growth based on high-tech industrial manufacturing with high rail speed networks, a smart electricity grid, renewable energy, and all that. But the thing is, capital didn't have any need to engage in this. And it also misunderstands fundamentally who Obama is and what his administration was all about. He was, after all, the largest recipient of money from Wall Street banks, commercial banks, the real estate industry, pension funds, hedge funds, the insurance industry, and on and on and on. He was the candidate of the elite, of the upper class, to ensure that the crisis, that the profits be made whole again, which is what happens, and that everyone else bears the cost. And there's also a second problem, which, suppose we carried out this Green New Deal, right? The fact of the matter is we don't have the technical or industrial base to be making all these high-tech goods like high-speed rail networks and the trains and the huge solar panel arrays and the hybrid batteries. A lot of this is now being done in Germany, South Korea, and especially China. So we would then be subsidizing all these firms. In other words, we would be subsidizing their profits to be creating all these goods, and yet other firms could then undercut these goods. They could come into the market with better goods and lower price goods. So then we would have to erect all these trade barriers, and we could set off this huge international trade war. Now, the funny thing is, in a lot of ways, this is going right back down the path of the 1930s, but as everyone knows, how did we get out of the Great Depression? Through this devastating world war, not right. Through the New Deal. The New Deal was largely symbolic. You know, it did put a few million people to work, but it didn't end the Great Depression. So it's funny how, by following uncritically this logic, people are falling in exactly the same traps. And, you know, we should recognize this basic history, that this was highly problematic. And, of course, it all comes apart in the revolt of the 1960s. This was revolt precisely against middle-class values, the banality of the middle-class lifestyle. The left has never been for the middle class. When you talk about the birth of the left was in opposition to petty bourgeois values and the mindset and that life. So why should we be defending the middle class now, and especially in this era of global ecocide, climate change, species extinction, the destruction of the oceans? How is basing an economy based on more and more and more consumption, especially with rising middle classes in India and China, going to really turn out well? It's like fighting for the middle class
again,
like fighting for global ecocide.
But to be a little bit devil's advocate, everything you said, I didn't jump to ask a question or to counter, but as you say that it was a revolt against petty bourgeois values, I would say it was a hybrid between the sense of economic injustice, I mean, among the working class. Why are we working every day 12 hours a day or even 8 hours a day in alienated labor and making so little while they make so much? I think it's a combination of that plus a revolt against petty bourgeois values that motivated the rise of the left throughout, you know, from the industrial era moving forward, till it actually gains more power across.
That's certainly true, but you know, especially when we get to the 1960s, and you know, you see these revolts in West Europe, even in the Eastern Bloc, in the United States. I mean, the Third World revolts have a different character, But nonetheless, in the industrialized world, you see all these revolts, and it's against bureaucratic collectivism, it's against European social democracy, it's against American capitalism with the social welfare states. It's, these were not meeting people's real needs.
Right, right, for sure.
Psychological and social and cultural needs. These
right.
were constructive societies.
Right, and it's a very, very strong point to realize. I mean, at no point in the 1970s, at the height of, say, English social democracy, would you ever have confused the housing and working class neighborhoods for the wealthy in London or in Sussex? So at no point do these European social democratic societies erase class differences. They're very highly pronounced, even in the 1970s, again, in the failings of the post-war era that you say Krugman gets all gooey-eyed about were quite real. And they need to be learned from. So to throw out the general question of the series Building a Powerful Left, with all the critique that you offer, what are things that you would put forward that you think are essential for people to focus on if a powerful, potentially socially transformative left were to emerge in the contemporary United States?
I think the left does a pretty poor job in terms of integrating culture and psychology into our critique and into and really into our politics, that people often mistake political revolution for social revolution, right? We don't want to change the cast of political characters. We want to fundamentally change social relations. And of course, that means means of production, but it also means gender relations, race relations, you know, in terms of identity, how we think of, say, for example, of whiteness, how we think of our sexuality and queerness. And of course, this is a huge order to engage in a revolution in so many ways. But I think one of the things that's hopeful is if we look at what's going on in Egypt, in this revolutionary moment, the political cast of characters were changed, but it is really about this social revolution where people's sense of themselves starts to change. And for so many Egyptian women spoke of just that wonderful liberating aspect of being able to be a social agent, to be able to be in public and engage in a political activity and debate and building a movement and to be free of sexual harassment. And that's a really beautiful thing. And we have to remember that we need to have a multifaceted revolution in terms of all these aspects. And I think, yes, there is at the core, we need to understand the role material relations play, such as the relations of production, because we live in a material universe, but we can't forget the power of ideas. With ideas that first propelled the Egyptian revolution, this virus of the Arab Spring, it's this idea that has spread from country to country to country. And so we can't ignore these factors, and I think the left has to really understand that it can't just be looking at material relations. It constantly looks at material relations, and this is a lot of the power of the Tea Party movement, that it really understands the role of psychology, of cultural aspects. The Tea Party movement, just the term Tea Party, it's hearkening back to this national mythology about our founding, when individuals, of course, straight white Christian males, but these individuals had power and the nation had power. And it's contrasted with now, where the individual is impotent and the nation is impotent. And you have to understand that this is why it has so much appeal, that it's really appealing to people's libidinal energies. And the left really doesn't do that well anymore. It used to do that in the 60s. With the thinkers like Herbert Marcuse and his critiques of society. But right now, it just tends to fight a losing battle for technocratic social programs. And again, I don't want to say these are unimportant. Of course, people need to have housing, health care, and we should be fighting to retain these programs. But this is not the end goal.
I think one of the keys to developing a set of, I apologize for using this term, but say radical or progressive memes that resonate in the cultural sphere do revolve. And again, this goes back to something technocratic, which is the devaluing and then defunding of education in the society. I mean, if you look at American society, you know, you look at the empire, and I know you're writing on the decline of the American empire, among other things. America still occupies a very unique culturally hegemonic space across the world. And I think in the past 5 to 10 years, the very material manifestations of that cultural hegemony have changed. And that's how dynamic American culture remains, because right now there are these Apple products, right, which we find out now track everywhere we go, from the iPod through to the iPad with the iPhone as the key. And everybody in the world wants them and uses them. And then Facebook and Twitter are, again, American cultural productions. So in American society, this incredibly dynamic, incredibly diverse, you know, Gertrude Stein had this line about modernism, that since America was in modernism longer than any country and the world was all becoming modern, that made America the oldest country in the world or the oldest culture in the world. Well, the same is true of postmodernity. America would be the country that sort of reaches this kind of a postmodern glut of postmodernity or whatever, however you want to describe postmodernity, unless I get into the details of that. And in that sense, we're the oldest country because we've been in it the longest, and we still sort of lead the world in the production of things in this cultural historical era that we're in. And there is somewhere in all of that, and I think it revolves around, you know, diversity, liberty of mind. These things can be taken by the left and utilized as revolutionary cultural memes in this culture if the left can find a way to frame these and grab these. Your thoughts on that?
Well, postmodernism is a gigantic can of worms.
Right, I agree.
This is part of the problem that the left finds itself in. Is, you know, there's a lot of brilliant people doing brilliant critiques out there, but this obsession over subjectivity and positionality and micro narratives and contingency. You know, there's a lot of important information and analysis in there, but it's also, we need to have meta narratives, right? And
right.
I see this all the time on the left, where people, they don't know what to do. They're afraid of organization. I've seen this particularly in segments of the anarchist left, where you often find some, no means all, some anarchists are anti-organization. And it's just like, how are you going to build anything without organization? So I think postmodernism, you know, we can't wish for a different history we have, but we need to move beyond the postmodern moment. In terms of what the U.S. is producing culturally, things like Facebook and Twitter, sure, these are useful tools, but they also get completely overplayed. The Egyptian Revolution did not happen because of Facebook and Twitter, and I doubt if it would have changed much because of Facebook and Twitter. When you talk to people who are really knowledgeable about what happened in Egypt, it was still the face-to-face organizing. It was still happening in storefronts, in neighborhoods, in things like flyering. This obsession with trying to act like Facebook and Twitter are dramatically changing or inspiring revolutions is absurd. Like with Iran's Green Revolution a couple of years ago, it kept being, oh, this is the Twitter revolution. It was repeated ad infinitum ad nauseum. And yet, no one realized, or a few people did, that, in fact, at that point, Twitter did not support Farsi. So the number of people in Iran who had a Twitter account was less than 1,000. So sure, it was useful for the West to get information of what was going on for a few days until the Iranian state, the Revolutionary Guard, started setting up all these Twitter accounts and pumping out disinformation. But it had nothing to do with inspiring that revolt. And the fact of the matter is, I haven't done a lot of international travel in the last few years, but I'm in touch with many journalists around the world. And I'm often hearing the same story, that American cultural influence is really starting to diminish. And people are looking to other countries, other regions. I mean, certainly in East Asia, it's all about China. People really aren't paying that much attention to the United States, at least not in the way that they used to 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right. But if one looks at the general geopolitical, geoeconomic transformations that are taking place in across the world in developing countries, in China, India in particular, I'm not saying that people are modeling their lives or following American culture on a day-in, day-out level, but I think the westernization effect is still very conspicuous.
it is to varying degrees, but it depends where you are. It depends, you know, which segments of society that you're at. Certainly, because in India, this growing middle class may be trying to adopt this idealized notion of the consumptive American middle class lifestyle. That's real for a lot of it, but you know, we should remember that this is only a small part of society overall, and not all Indians buy into it who have this social, cultural, and economic capital to be in what is considered the middle class, and that the weight of history, I think, still in India at least, lies with the poor, the peasantry, the workers, the dispossessed.
And I think I agree very much with your fundamental point about Egypt, too, which is that you talk at the end of the essay that I've cited from Alternet about the need to embrace human liberation as opposed to the regeneration of a middle class that existed with all sorts of problems 40 or 50 years ago. And you're right that in Egypt, there was not just the overthrow of Mubarak there. There clearly was a real human liberatory element at the core of what was transpiring there, and we all were thrilled to see it. And the question is how in the domestic United States, since that's been the framing of these interviews that I've been doing in this series, how is it that that liberatory impulse returns to being at the core, a revitalized left in America? And at least in framing the question, I want to thank you for hitting the nail on the head so well in that regard.
Thank you, Alan. It's been an engaging conversation.
I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, and Arun Gupta is a founding editor of The Independent newspaper, which is printed out of New York City, and he is writing a book on the decline of American empire for Haymarket Books. Thank you so much for joining us, Arun Gupta.
Thank you, and folks can read and subscribe to The Independent by going to independent.org. That's with a Y, I-N-D-Y-P-E-N-D-E-N-T.org.